Hello there. It's time for episode 2 of this indie season that we're having. It's been a couple of weeks since I did the last episode, which was, of course, I Bet That You Look Good on the Dance Floor. Thank you to those who have listened. This week, we're beginning with the backdrop of Atlantis to Interzone by the Klaxons. Now, on my Bebo profile, which no longer exists, thank goodness, in the music section, the opening line of mine said, "I'm finding the Klaxons shit hot at the moment." And that was a serious opening line to look cool on Bebo. I also like this backdrop because of that use of the DJ mode, which reminds me, again, this is all a nostalgia trip really, but it reminds me of being at secondary school. I don't know if you remember those keyboards that had that DJ mode. I don't know why I keep having to do the exact voice for it. They had the DJ mode, and my form tutor was Mr. Flanagan, and he was the head of music, so we were surrounded by these keyboards, and you could make funny noises on it, including some of the ones that are sampled in this song. So that's why I like to use that backdrop, because they're an indie band, but also they've got that sort of DJ keyboard usage as well. Just going to stop that there. This week, I thought, or I say week, this fortnight, I thought we'd look at I Write Sins Not Tragedies by Panic at the Disco. This was one of those songs that is sort of in the emo genre, I suppose, but it was almost universally liked. Even Chavies liked this one. So I think it's still a pretty decent track, and I think, although not that detailed in terms of lyrics, I think there's a little bit of a story to it to look into. So I thought we'd look at that today. So we're going to look at I Write Sins Not Tragedies by Panic at the Disco. Let's jump straight in anyway.
Well, imagine as I'm pacing the pews in a church corridor, and I can't help but to hear, no, I can't help but to hear an exchanging of words. What a beautiful wedding, what a beautiful wedding, says a bridesmaid to a waiter. Yes, but what a shame, the poor groom's bride is a whore.
All right, going to pause there because we're just about to approach the chorus. Some of you will know this word for word, this song, but I thought maybe I could shed my own views, a bit of light on my own views on some of the lyrics of this song. So we begin, as one or two songs I've looked at before, in media res, that means thrown into the middle of things. Oh, well, imagine as I'm pacing the pews in a church corridor. So we're thrown into the middle of what is a wedding scene, and that is immediately apparent to us because of the church and because of the repeated phrase, what a beautiful wedding, which we'll look at in a minute. Pacing the pews in a church corridor, well, I think this song's all about infidelity, and, you know, maybe there's a bit of hypocrisy here, the band Panic at the Disco, Brendan Urie, I think that's how you say his surname, and the others in that band, I don't really know their names, but they are talking about the hypocrisy of people getting married in church, but infidelity is rife in relationships and in society in general. So the church corridor and the pews are mentioned straight away, and I think that will highlight the hypocrisy of many relationships. Anyway, let's jump on. It says, "And I can't help but to hear, no, I can't help but hear to an exchanging of hear an exchanging of words. What a beautiful wedding, what a beautiful wedding," says a bridesmaid to a waiter. So the bridesmaid is saying to the waiter, what a beautiful wedding. The bridesmaid could be a sister of the bride, or a sister of the groom, or a cousin, or a best friend. It could be anyone, really, couldn't it? But that's usually the category for that. Now, maybe the bridesmaid is unaware of aforementioned infidelity, and I think the waiter would be unaware. Although, the reply is, "And yes, but what a shame. What a shame the poor groom's bride is a whore." So is that the waiter saying that to the bridesmaid? I'm not quite clear on that there, and I'd love to hear your views on that. But it, or is it the bridesmaid adding that on as a sort of caveat, or like sort of batteries not included at the end there? I don't know. But what I do know is there's a few things here. I suppose the patriarchy is omnipresent, as we know, and it is in the final line of this sort of pre-chorus, if you like. The poor groom's bride, so that's possessive, the groom owns the bride, and she is depicted as a whore. Now, infidelity takes sort of two to tango, I suppose, but it's the bride who is labelled a whore. And something I've mentioned before, even when I talk to students at school about words used for promiscuous women versus words used for promiscuous men. And the list is extensive for women, isn't it? I'm not going to read them all out or reel them all off. I haven't got a pre-prepared list, by the way. But, you know, words like whore, slag, slut, you know, really derogatory phrases. Whereas for men, it's words such as player. And I'm sure there are many others as well. But it's almost a celebratory word for men, isn't it? And that's another example of the patriarchy, which many of us believe needs smashing. I don't know if I feel that way about it, but I certainly feel uncomfortable with the inequality of the sort of extremities or the extreme nature of some of the phrases for women as opposed to men. I usually look at the title, "I Write Sins, Not Tragedies." Well, they're not really, mutually exclusive things, but sins and tragedies, I think in this sense, the sins are the committer of the sin, i.e. the people committing infidelity, the cheaters, if you like, and the tragedy is, the poor groom or those involved who are hurt by this sin. And that fits in nicely, actually. There is a classic tragedy by John Ford called "'Tis Pity She's a Whore," which was written in the 1630s, roughly. And that final line fits with that. And why am I mentioning that? Well, that play is a tragedy. I don't know it that well. I think there's incest involved as well. And, of course, infidelity. Lots of death and stabbing. So maybe Brendan Urie, or whoever wrote this song, I don't know who wrote it, was tipping their cap to that famous tragedy by John Ford. I think it fits well, as it is a tragedy, and tragedy is in the title. Let's play a bit more anyway. We're going on to the chorus. Well, I chimed in with a "haven't you people ever heard of closing the goddamn door?" I chimed in. So the poetic voice is mentioning that to chime in is to sort of interrupt, isn't it? Or to, have your say during a discussion or something like that. I don't know who the I is. Are they a friend, or are they a conscience or something? I don't think it's ever clear. But whoever it is, the poetic voice chimes in with a haven't you ever, people ever heard of closing the goddamn door. I think that's a nice sort of symbol or metaphor. What is the door? Is the door, you know, keeping some privacy in your life? Is the door symbolic of, I don't know, the lady's legs or something like that? Is it just a door in general, as in, have they been caught in the act in a sort of toilet cubicle? So I think there's a few ways of looking at that image. But either way, this omniscient sort of narrator, if you like, has chimed in to try and resolve the situation. Now it goes on, the chorus, to say, it's much better to face these kinds of things with a sense of poise and rationality. Now, I think this is quite clever here, and I don't know, again, I don't know if they meant it, but poise and rationality, well, if you dealt with something with poise and rationality, it means that you're sort of maybe going to deal with it elegantly, maturely, without violence or without too much conflict or confrontation. But I think there is a bit of a play on here, isn't it? Poise and rationality sounds a bit like poison rationality, as in toxicity, I suppose. So there's something in that as well. If you stay rational in this scenario, maybe it will be, I suppose the impact could be corrosive and insidious. I don't know, but that's how I've read it. And then the chorus repeats itself, and then it smooth, sort of fluidly goes into verse two. So I sort of paused it when it was on, it started with another O, so we'll play a bit more. There's actually not too many lyrics this song, so we're doing well.
Well, in fact, well, I'll look at it this way. I mean, technically, our marriage is saved. Well, this calls for a toast, so pour the champagne. Oh, well, in fact, well, I'll look at it this way. I mean, technically, our marriage is saved. Well, this calls for a toast, so pour the champagne, pour the champagne.
And then we have a sort of instrumental build up to the chorus again. Oh, well, in fact, well, I'll look at it this way. I mean, technically, our marriage is saved. So is the I the groom then? I don't know. Because they're saying, I mean, technically, our marriage is saved. But this is quite ambiguous, this part, isn't it? Because is the marriage saved because things have been revealed and they can move on now that they know the truth? Or is it saved from being a sinful marriage? I.e. they can cut it off now that information has been leaked about the infidelity that I've mentioned a few times now. I don't know, but it calls for a toast either way. And when you usually toast positivity to a long, happy marriage, to wealth, to success, whatever. But in this case, maybe they're toasting a near miss with a sin-filled relationship that could have ended in tragedy. Maybe tragedy has been averted. And that's repeated again. Pour the champagne at the end there. Champagne, of course, a higher class drink, drunk at celebrations, like weddings, for example. That's repeated. Let's get some alcohol down us. Shall we forget these sins, or shall we celebrate that, yes, we've learnt about the sins, but this wedding is going to be cut off and therefore no sin-filled marriage from this day forward. After that, we go into the chorus again. There's not really any more lyrics after that, so it's quite a short one, this one. But I thought it was definitely worth exploring. Let's listen to the sort of highly built up chorus once more, and I'll see if I've got any final thoughts for you to send us on our way.
Closing the goddamn door, no, it's much better to fix these kinds of things. But there's a voice of rationality. I chime in, how did you people
right, that'll do us. We've spoken about most of that, but I like the adverb again there. Lots of repetition in this song and lots of repetitions in songs in general, I suppose. But maybe the again here suggests that this is not a first-time sin, it's not a first-time offence, and therefore tragedy has been averted this time, but will it happen again and again? Maybe the repetition throughout this song creates that sort of cyclical nature of infidelity among some people. So my final thoughts on this song then, apart from it being a great nostalgia trip and transporting me back to being sort of 16, going to house parties or to the Manor Club or wherever every weekend, this song for me is talking about that cycle that unfaithful people go on. I think that's part of it. But I also think that there's maybe a warning to the listener that, you know, don't get to the point of marriage and then find out this stuff. You've got to have 100% trust. And yes, you might not be able to find out such things if you have a stealthy partner. But I think it's about, you know, finding out these things for yourself and you know, being real with yourself. You know, how can everyone else know in this scenario but not you? And it took, in this song, it took some sort of strange onlooker or narrator who overheard a conversation between the bridesmaid and the waiter to reveal the information. So closing the goddamn door is important, but I think openness and honesty is perhaps more important here. That's it. Thank you. Let me know if you've got any more suggestions. I'm still going to do a few more songs for this season, and then I will definitely be going on to some R&B, hip-hop, whatever, classics from the mid-noughties, maybe early noughties. See you later.